Today is Tuesday, August 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, recent skirmishes in the Kashmir region have killed at least 35 people, according to officials.
These figures clearly indicate that the situation is much more serious than what is being reported by both the sides.
Also ahead, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is demanding that the so-called Irish backstop be removed from the Brexit deal. But what's really at stake? And this August marks the 400th anniversary of the landing of the first enslaved Africans in the U.S. Those stories and more are next. Officials report that recent cross-border skirmishes between Pakistan and India have killed at least 35 people and injured hundreds on the Pakistani side of the disputed Kashmir region. For more details, I spoke with Ayaz Gul in Islamabad.
Well, these figures that were released today by the president of the Pakistani-administered Kashmir are quite, shocking in a way that we know that these clashes have been going on across the disputed Kashmir border for the last 2 weeks. But we also know that Indian side also has come up with some casualty figures of their own. But these figures clearly indicate that the situation is much more serious than what is being reported by both the sides. And that is why we understand that within a week, President Donald Trump has picked up the phone and spoken to Prime Minister Imran Khan twice and Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India, basically urging them to show restraint because there are fears that this situation can really get out of control and could lead to a major conflict between the two countries.
Right. So urging restraint is very much important to try and alleviate the threat of casualties. But what are officials really going to be able to do to alleviate the violence?
Well, that is a good question, because both the sides are sticking to their traditional positions on Kashmir. And Pakistan has been consistently demanding that India reverse its actions of August 5th when it stripped its portion of Kashmir of its constitutional autonomy. And that is what Pakistan has been, saying that unless that is reversed and that security lockdown and the communication blackout in Indian Kashmir that has been there now for almost 2 weeks should be lifted before any dialogue or discussion can take place between the two countries on this issue. So, I mean, as far as bilateralism is concerned, Pakistan says it is not going to have any discussion with India directly unless these steps are taken. And India continues to maintain that whatever it has done in its part of Kashmir is under its own constitution. But obviously, that position is in question after the UN Security Council held a closed-door meeting discussing Indian actions. So that is where an international intervention was required, and maybe that's what prompted President Trump to really tell these two countries to reduce tensions. But so far, we don't see any indication on the ground, because the president of the Pakistani Kashmir today told a crowded news conference that these clashes across the line of control which separates Pakistani and Indian Kashmir are still ongoing.
What else do we need to know about what's going on in Kashmir?
There have been violent protests, street protests, but then we have also seen that there has been a serious retaliation from the Indian security forces. What has happened in the meantime that We know that Indian Kashmir has been, witnessing this Muslim insurgency, and which India alleges that Pakistan is supporting. But right now, what has happened is that those pro-India Kashmiri leaders who have long opposed the insurgent groups and who have always respected the Indian constitution have also been detained since August 5th when India scrapped the constitutional autonomy for Kashmir, and those Indian, pro-Indian Kashmiri leaders remain in custody. No one knows what is happening to them, and Indian media itself has reported that as many as 4,000 people are currently being detained, and they include politicians, activists, and even human rights, civil society representatives.
Ayaz Ghul reports for VOA from Islamabad. Thank you very much for those updates.
Thank you, Steve.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has fired the opening salvo in his bid to renegotiate Britain's divorce from the European Union, demanding that an insurance policy for the Irish border be removed from the Brexit deal and replaced with a pledge. After more than 3 years of Brexit crisis, Britain is heading toward a showdown with the EU as Johnson has vowed to leave the bloc on October 31st without a deal unless it agrees to renegotiate the divorce terms. The bloc and its leaders have repeatedly refused to reopen the withdrawal agreement, which includes a protocol on the Irish border backstop that then Prime Minister Theresa May agreed to in November. The backstop was a compromise. It would keep Britain in a customs union with the EU until a better solution was found and keep Northern Ireland aligned with the rules of the EU's single market. Johnson wrote that the backstop was anti-democratic and threatened Britain's sovereignty, as the application of the single market rules in Northern Ireland could divide Northern Ireland from the rest of the United Kingdom. But what impact would removing the Irish backstop have on trade, and who would be worse off for it? For that, I spoke with Jacob Kierkegaard, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I began our conversation by asking him, what is the practical impact of removing the backstop, and is it just about the hard border?
In short, yes. But, of course, this being Northern Ireland, it's about a lot more.
So what is it really about, then?
It's really about violence.
And that's one of the main concerns, is that if the backstop is gone, we're going to return to a series of violent acts along the border, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, not only are you going to have very significant economic dislocation, the Irish agricultural industry, there's a whole host of industries and people commuting and all these things that will be, have very significant obstacles placed in front of it. But the real concern is that one of the fundamental tenets of the Good Friday peace agreement that led to of reconciliation in Northern Ireland was that the border should cease to exist.
So who is going to be worse off if there is a so-called hard Brexit, if the Irish backstop is removed, as Boris Johnson has indicated he wishes to happen? Is it going to be Britain? Is it going to be the EU? Is it going to be everyone?
Well, I think if it actually turns out that there is a return to violence in Northern Ireland, the people who are going to be absolutely worse affected are the people of Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic in the border areas there. There's no doubt about that, because not only will they take a very, very significant negative economic impact, but they will have their, lives threatened. They're going to go back to something that could easily approach civil war conditions again. But more broadly, Ireland will pay a significant economic price for a no-deal Brexit. If you look at the EU as a whole, I think the impact will be negative. But because the EU is big and the main impact is concentrated in a relatively limited number of member states, namely Ireland, Belgium, the Netherlands, France, and Germany, all of which currently have strong economies, even though Germany right now might be entering into a shallow recession and all that. But basically, these are countries that can easily afford it. Overall, the EU will take a limited negative economic effect. A much more negative effect you will have in the United Kingdom.
Jacob Kierkegaard is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thank you very much for your insight today.
My pleasure.
Among other top stories in the world, Britain's Foreign Office says it is extremely concerned by reports that an employee at its Hong Kong consulate has been detained in mainland China. Days after a mysterious explosion at a Russian naval test site caused radiation detectors to briefly spike, silence at several monitoring stations has raised fears that Moscow is hiding the extent of the blast that killed five people. An unmanned Indian space probe successfully entered lunar orbit, passing a crucial step toward a historic milestone for the country's fledgling space program. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and with our VOA mobile app. This is VOA News.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. military has just tested a ground-based cruise missile with a range that would have been banned a mere 3 weeks ago. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has those details.
The Pentagon says the missile was launched from an island off California's coast and hit its target after more than 500 kilometers of flight. That distance is important. The United States previously could not pursue ground-based missiles with a range between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. They were locked in the INF, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, a decades-old arms control pact with Russia. VOA previously reported that Washington withdrew from that pact on August 2nd, citing years of Russian violations. The Pentagon stressed that this cruise missile was not configured to carry a nuclear weapon, but rather a conventional payload, the type of conventional ground-based missile that new Secretary of Defense Mark Esper recently said he'd like to put in Asia.
We would like to deploy a capability sooner rather than later because of the importance of the great distances we need to cover and how important an intermediate range conventional weapon would be to the Asia Indo-PACOM theater.
Esper declined to tell us when or where the missiles could be deployed within the region during his trip there this month. Analysts primarily have focused on what the INF treaty withdrawal means for signatory nations Russia and the United States. But they say the end of the INF could be allowing the United States to strengthen its position against China. According to Esper, more than 80% of China's missile inventory has a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Russia's TASS news agency reported Moscow has accused the United States on Tuesday of stoking military tensions by testing a ground-launched cruise missile, but said it would not be drawn into an arms race. TASS quoted Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov saying, quote, "All this elicits regret. The United States has obviously taken the course of escalating military tensions. We will not succumb to provocations. We won't allow ourselves to be pulled into a costly arms race," end quote. China has also expressed concern. In Beijing, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Geng Shuang said the test showed the United States was stoking a new arms race and confrontation, which would have been a serious negative impact on regional and global security. The leaders of the United States, France, Britain, Germany, Italy, Japan, and Canada will come together to discuss major global challenges on Saturday at the annual meeting of the G7 group of industrialized nations. As hosts, French President Emmanuel Macron has made fighting inequality the theme of the summit and has invited several other world leaders to attend. But Henry Ridgewell reports any grand ambitions for the summit will likely be stymied by more pressing concerns.
Economic storm clouds threaten to engulf the meeting in the French resort of Biarritz. In recent days, indicators from both sides of the Atlantic show worrying signs. Government bond yields in the United States and Germany were briefly higher for two-year than 10-year bonds, a sign that investors see significant risks ahead, says economist Jasper Lawler of London Capital Group.
Particularly in the US, has actually been a very reliable signal to point towards a recession.
What's more, the usual fiscal tools to tackle a recession might not be available.
We don't have that usual fallback from central banks of cutting interest rates because they already have and they're already at rock bottom levels.
The economic fears are rooted in the trade war between the US and China, which has resulted in both countries imposing import tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of each other's goods. Europe is suffering additional headwinds.
The trade war, but also just the auto sector, the transition from using diesel cars to electronic vehicles. It's a period of uncertainty that's unduly affecting Europe.
Summit host France is determined not to let economics overshadow its own agenda. And top of the list is climate change, says analyst John Curtin of the G7 Research Group at the University of Toronto.
Driven by the scary science, which is unfolding every day, but more importantly, by the historically high heat waves that have afflicted Europe, including France.
US President Donald Trump left last year's G7 summit in Canada early and later disavowed the final communique. This year, France is determined to keep the United States on board, says Curtin.
President Macron, I think, has structured his agenda to allow Donald Trump to be at his best. Gender equality, the president's been very good on that, is at the top of the French list. Education, yes. Health.
Security concerns will also top the agenda, with North Korea resuming its ballistic missile tests and Iran seizing oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. This year, the anti-government protests in Russia and Hong Kong also pose questions for the G7.
Have we seen the tide where authoritarian leaders in various degrees are no longer in control? It may not be the wave of the future. In fact, if that's the case, then how can the G7 activate its distinctive foundational mission to promote democracy?
Meanwhile, new British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will meet Trump for the first time. Both leaders are hoping for a rapid trade deal amid signs of a steep economic downturn in Britain as it edges closer to crashing out of the European Union with no deal. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers from Spain's University of Barcelona and the French Besançon Astronomical Observatory suggests that the Milky Way galaxy experienced a period of intense star-making about 2 to 3 billion years ago. Writing in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, the scientists reached their findings by analyzing data gathered by the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite. The researchers say they found that about half of the stars that make up the Milky Way's galactic disk were created during the stellar baby boom. Before the time of this boost in star formation, the scientists suggest that our galaxy was beginning to run low on the gas used to make stars when a satellite galaxy crashed into and merged with the Milky Way. It's thought that the satellite galaxy was rich with this gas, and when it merged with our home galaxy, boosted its star-making capabilities. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. This August marks the 400th anniversary of the landing of the first enslaved Africans in Virginia, a state on the eastern coast of the United States. Their arrival was the start of what would become one of the darkest chapters in U.S. history, 224 years of slavery. VOA's Chris Simpkins documented the events where history was made and reported on how these first African slaves, along with the many who followed and their descendants, shaped the course of a nation.
So, Chris, I really wanted to talk about this project and specifically your experiences with it. You did a number of interviews and you met several people along the way. What really stood out to you and about their stories?
It was an eye-opening experience for me because I'm an African-American growing up in the South in the 1970s. Never read or saw a lot about this history. There was very much little in terms of the history of slavery in our textbooks. And when we did see passages about slavery, it was always from the standpoint that the enslaved people from Africa came to colonial America with little or no skills, and they learned everything once they reached the new world, so to speak. But in my reporting, I found out that that was simply not the case, that the arrival of the first enslaved Africans, they all came here with skills, agricultural skills, political skills. They were baptized. They had their own names, which were eventually taken from them. So that was amazing in and of itself. Also, I didn't know about the arrival of the first enslaved Africans who came to what is now Hampton, Virginia in 1619, the latter part of August, and where their lives began and where they ended up was all new to me and very fascinating in terms of reporting.
Can you share a little bit about that? I mean, as they arrived here, they were enslaved and taken elsewhere. Where do their families, you know, descend from now?
Well, we see a lot in the same very same area that they arrived in, the Hampton Roads, Virginia area, the Norfolk, Hampton, Virginia Beach areas of Virginia. And what I learned was that these first enslaved people came over. They were not actually slaves at that time because the colony of Virginia had not codified slavery until 1661.
So what did they come over as then?
They came over basically as what we know as indentured servants. They worked alongside white indentured servants who were under contract, who came primarily from England, and they had no status at that time, Steve, so they were held against their will, but it wasn't until laws that were later passed in Virginia that officially said that they would be slaves. Anyone born to any children born from them would be slaves for life. Basically, the hardship and humiliation of slavery did not end with the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery in 1865, and that African Americans continued to endure racist violence, entrenched poverty, and inequities in areas such as education, employment, and the criminal justice system. And I found out these are legacies today that we in this country have to deal with. That is a direct result of what began 400 years ago.
Chris Simpkins reports for VOA and his video series about the 1619 slave trade can be found on the voanews.com website. Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure to be with you, Steve.
And in related news, it was on this day in 1862 that the New York Tribune published an open letter by editor Horace Greeley calling on President Abraham Lincoln to take a more aggressive step to free the slaves and end the South's rebellion. But it was in 1866 that President Andrew Johnson formally declared that the Civil War was over, months after the fighting had actually stopped. But also looking back in history, it was on this day in 1953 that the Soviet Union publicly acknowledged it had tested a hydrogen bomb. And in 2017, actor, comic, and longtime telethon host Jerry Lewis died of heart disease in Las Vegas at the age of 91. And with that, that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. And on behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Thomas Blondette, and managing editor Paul Alexander, thank you very much for listening. You'll find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile app, You can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Make it a great day.